Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree.
Patricia travels to Vashon Island, Washington, to spend time with Vernon, who becomes her boyfriend. She meets a man named Dwayne Harrington, who shows her a tiny bottle full of broken pieces of glass, which resonates with her and reminds her of her Kentucky grandparents. Vashon Island, Washington, is strange to the point of mythical. Coastal tribes considered it sacred and did not inhabit it. Castle-sized mounds of blackberry brambles burst with fruit under which children play fort and cowboys and Indians, and something hangs in the air, the scent of salt water, I suppose, with the sweet aroma of purple juice staining the hands and faces of children and dripping from the beaks of airborne gulls, heady, intoxicating. After 15 minutes of standing on the ferry's foredeck with that same sea air on my face, we dock, and I wait in the line of cars for the uniformed worker's arm signal telling us to disembark. The pilings are draped with heavy ropes and things nautical. The ramp looks rickety, but is, in fact, solid, and so the civic and I ascend to the paved road, consulting Vernon's penciled map. His cabin is green and tiny and sits on a mound of earth back from the street. As with the rest of the island, flora are abundant, flowers and verdant lawns, rhododendrons, lilacs, calendula, tulips, geraniums in pots and window boxes. I peruse the saddle-colored 1970s Mercedes sitting in the driveway, walk onto the cabin's small deck. "Great car," I say. He greets me with a hug and a kiss. My reasons for being on the west side of Washington State this weekend actually have little to do with Vernon, whom I recently met at a bed and breakfast called the Old Mill House, which sits at the base of Mount Rainier in a village called Eatonville, where Brett and Zach and I go one weekend a month to spend time together and to take in the region's art and culture in the form of Third Saturday concerts sponsored by the B&B. I've been sent to attend an Indian Health Service Nursing Administrators Conference at the Red Lion at SeaTac, but Vernon is smitten with me, makes a nuisance of himself, refusing to take no for an answer. My preoccupation with him overshadows my duties. He is, after all, a published poet, the first I've ever known, and he wants to take me to dinner in downtown Seattle, arriving at my hotel Monday afternoon dressed in black jeans and a black silk shirt and a black tuxedo jacket and black boots. He looks like a city boy, as I imagine an urbane intellectual from New York and Chicago might, both of which are places in which he's lived and worked as a marketing executive. And here I am, the hillbilly girl whose father stores dead cars in the yard, and whose mother drinks sweet tea all day long, and whose favorite story used to be the Pied Piper of Hamelin, wishing to possess the sleek edginess and long, slender legs of those city women, wanting to know. After dinner, Vernon takes me to a literary reading at Elliott Bay Books, Michael Mead reading from his book, Men and the Living Water. I've never heard of such a thing. I've never heard of authors reading their own books aloud to other people. My school principal at Edwardsville Elementary once led me from classroom to classroom to read and spell for the other students, and a little group of us used to perform my plays, but I did not know people did this. Across the audience is a man named Dwayne Harrington, to whom Vernon had introduced me at the Dog Day Cafe in downtown Vashon the day I first arrived. What was between those two? Dwayne's insane hair, wide flirtatious grin, chewing gum, his torch of sexual energy directed straight at Vernon, and his partner Luca Terwilliger, blonde, tall, with a wedged torso and equally virile, either oblivious or enjoying the spectacle. And then Vernon's response to my question later that night. "Are you a bisexual?" I ask. "Yes," he says. "I guess I am. I never wanted to admit it, but I guess it's time." A man with an almost ex-wife and two children. A man with whom I've had sex. I insist he get tested for everything, herpes, syphilis, HIV, and refuse further intimate contact. I make him sleep in one queen-size Red Lion bed while I sleep in the other. On my car the next afternoon, a note with the words, "You are beautiful," and a Chinese character whose meaning I discover means both heart and hearth. I eventually invite Vernon to come live with us in Lewiston. I learn to smoke marijuana and drink hard liquor daily. He drives the Mercedes back and forth over Snoqualmie Pass, eventually bringing a U-Haul until his possessions fill my home's empty spaces. My houseplants grow as if shot with vitamins, and I think it's because of the love in my house. We fall asleep reading poetry. He's a marvel in the kitchen. We dine on vegetarian dishes, tofu enchiladas, and barbecued lentil loaf. The weekends we are childless, Vernon and I raft the Clearwater, six-pack of beer floating from a rope. Saturday nights are spent at a place called Tomfoolery in Lewiston. We dance to local classic rock bands until closing. And other things I've never done before, simple poetic things such as buying fresh, out-of-season organic raspberries for the breakfast granola, cooking food co-op espresso instead of Folgers in a Turkish contraption on top of the stove, sneaking sips of cognac and something called Jägermeister in the bedroom at night. All of this makes me very glad until I discover the three spare trash cans in the storeroom, full to the brim with empty beer cans. On one particular weekend when Mark has the boys, Vernon travels to Vashon Island to visit his children. I go along, hungry for salt air and freedom. We stay at the canyon home of Dwayne Harrington and Luca Terwilliger. Dwayne is writing a novel. Luca works in the ER as a CAS technician at Harborview Medical Center, is an advocate for Seattle's monochrome people. The decks of their beautiful redwood home are filled with pots of red geraniums, ancient cedars draped with moss that looks to me like witch's hair stands sentinel over the courtyard between the house and Dwayne's writing studio. Bald eagles master the sky overhead, gulls swoop and scream, herons bat their lumbering wings like little pterodactyls, gray and surreal. The place is spooky but magical, two-story, sky-lit, open-beam ceilings, windows lined with charms, seashells, sliced geodes and other rocks, old cobalt blue medicine bottles, crystals and beads, hanks of herbs tied with cotton twine, a horseshoe nailed upside down to a door frame leading from the sitting room to a side deck makes me feel creepy, as if it were a crucifix. Gargoyles protrude like mastheads from every trunk-sized support beam. A brown metal bedstead with the requisite hand-painted rose on the headboard under the stairwell. Pillows and mattress draped and tucked beneath a white chenille bedspread straight from the living room of one of my grandmother's mountain shacks. "It's so the luck won't run out of it," Dwayne says when I ask about the upside-down horseshoe. "Do you have anything else in this house that brings you luck?" I ask. "Luca," he says, "go and get me Lila May's bottle off the drain board." This is when I should have fainted, or run. The bottle, the size and shape of a 1-ounce vanilla bottle and filled with broken pieces of colored glass, is a replica of one Grandpa Darnell kept in his glass front bookcase, which he made himself, bubbly glass and all, as a present to Grandma Hattie after he got out of prison. Dwayne is nonplussed as I break into sobbing. A song is playing in the background. "Calling all angels, walk me through this one, don't leave me alone." Luca and Vernon, observing from overstuffed chairs in opposite corners of the living room, each wave hello when I look to them for explanation. "You feel that, don't you?" Dwayne says. "Which I do. I feel something. Energy is radiating from the bottle. I close it in my palm, feel a presence pass close to me, tuck it into my pocket for safekeeping, and a day later, take it home." Maybe it is only coincidence, but I arrived back to Lewiston with a sense of clarity I've never owned. On Monday, the McSorley school principal calls my office to tell me Zach has once again disrupted class, this time by cutting off his pants legs in the middle of his math lesson. A spanking new pair of black denims for which he begged and which I could not afford, but bought anyway, on the JCPenney card. He hated them, he told his teacher, because they were not Levi's. On Tuesday, after much counsel from Ellen Barton and Toby Perez, I asked to take yet another day of annual leave, load Zach's clothing and belongings into the back seat and trunk of the Honda, including the two parakeets and cages I purchased for his birthday. He needs to resolve his issues with his father, they tell me. It's time for tough love. He needs to be shocked awake, or he will be lost. And so, I do it. I drive to school in a chill speckle of rain without calling ahead and pull my youngest son from his fourth grade class to retrace the span of miles over Rattlesnake Grade and Snow Hollow Hill, past the skyward Wallowa Mountains and the Eagle Cap Wilderness and the December hum of the Minum River to Le Grand and Mark's new real estate office. I'm sorry I'm such an asshole, Mom, was the only sentence to come out of Zach's mouth during the entire three-hour trip. I spend my nights behind the door of my bedroom with Vernon. Brett writes little missives and slips them under the door. Trouble is like a runaway train. You can't stop it by putting something in its path. Someone must pull the emergency brake. September 9th, 10:30 p.m., 1993. The devil has hold of the human mind, but God has put butter on the devil's fingers. 9:23:93, 9:35 p.m. For just a lung full of fresh autumn air, some men would open-heartedly die for it. What one man thinks is totally crazy, another man thinks is totally sane. The battle between good and evil, dark and light, God and the devil is eternal. It has lasted from the beginning of time, and at present evil has taken over, but one day the battle will end and the earth will with it. One cannot learn only in schools. One must go out into the real world and learn by one's own mistakes. 10:14:93, 8:40 p.m. 3 months later, after Vernon and Brett and I moved to Coeur d'Alene so I can assume my post with the Coeur d'Alene tribe and he a position as a marketing executive with a software company, Vernon loses the custody battle for his daughters, Starlight and India. He deals with his grief by buying a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, leather chaps and jacket, ankle strap boots, brass-studded panniers. We ride sans helmets, and I wear long, flowing dresses. My hair by then is waist-length, streaked platinum, and wavy as a wheat field. We look like poster children for midlife crisis, but see ourselves as savvy, free-spirited mavericks. Time on a Harley is spiritual. The modern-day horse, Vernon calls it. One day, Brett tries to climb onto the Harley when no one's around. He is 12, maybe 5'2". He dislodges the kickstand and tries to balance the bike, but his feet don't touch the ground. The behemoth crashes sideways and he jumps clear, scared to move, wondering what he'll say to Vernon, what he'll do if the thing suddenly explodes like things do in movies and on TV. It was a heavy pollen year, and I think of my dove-eyed, soft-lidded 11-year-old lying on the ground as yellow motes drift and settle on his jeans, his t-shirt, his soap-scented skin, and wonder whether he connects the color yellow with cowardice. He can, after all, ride the bike and pretend it never happened. Instead, he sits beside it on the gravel, watching for gasoline and oil leaks. Vernon and I arrive home not too long after to find Brett crying, sobs stringy and funeral deep as the day he was beat up at Lapway. The bike is unharmed and Vernon forgiving, but the event changes Brett, something like a note of self-loathing. I told him about the story of my being six and a flower girl at a neighbor's wedding. I forgot to throw the petals and was frightened by my error. I begged Daddy to make them do the service over again. You will only get one chance to do it right, my daddy said. But I don't think that's true, I said to Brett. You get a million more chances. Always trust yourself enough to take a risk. Before long, Brett decided to follow Zach back to Oregon. Vernon and I spent off time riding the Harley. We rode all the way to Sturgis, South Dakota for the annual Harley rally in 1994. Four of us humans, I the lone female, three bikes and an Aerostar with a bike trailer in tow. One of the Harleys, belonging to a Vashon Island teacher named Bruce, who also owned the minivan and trailer, was a fragile 1970s era shovelhead subject to breakdown and the need for adjustment, so it spent most of the trip on the trailer and Bruce most of his time driving the van. This freed Vernon and I to ride all the way on the back of his new Dynaglide, 4 days of U.S. interstate across the northern Rockies and the Great Plains, and no good coffee east of Butte, but plenty of cheap beer. A motorcycle tank doesn't hold very much gas. 2 hours we had to stop for a fill-up, and every 2 hours Vernon insisted everyone drink another beer. We all voluntarily took a hit off the pipe. All the way to South Dakota with the wind in my hair, surrendering to the gods and the elements with a buzz on. Camping at Sturgis was expensive, $80 a night for a tissue-sized spot of ground, room enough for the van and trailer and three tents closely spaced. The air outside was green with mown field and marijuana. Inside any restaurant or bar or grocery, the smell changed to clay brick with the waft of leather encasing human sweat and unwashed skin, chaps over thongs with butt cheeks hanging dimpled and not dimpled, vests over haired chests and bikini bras, fringe swinging from every leg seam and bent elbow, beauty and beast. Bathing was a 30 to 60 minute wait for a spot in a cold communal shower partitioned by a wall to separate the sexes. All conversation concerned pistons, valves, and skin. No one ate other than a few plates of diner eggs. On one or two evenings I smelled the roast air of propane-fired meat. The ground pulsed from the jolt of 100,000 Harley engines. We smoked pot with some men from Australia. A half-hidden sign on a booth at the open market advertised hits of nitrous oxide for $10. Vernon was in heaven. We shopped every leather vendor for chaps to fit my thighs to no avail. Leather chaps in a woman's extra large don't equal even a size 10. I was a solid 12. I was soothed somewhat when I dozed off at a Dire Straits concert and not one but two photographers asked to take my photo. A model gorgeous couple with all-over tans rode around the campground stark naked, spitting white gravel and dirt. A jiggling big-as-beautiful couple did the same, having to put a foot down on the turn. A dark-haired woman in a black camisole shirt walked through our campsite twisting her own nipples. "Anything happening here?" she asked. Vernon invited her for a beer, but she kept playing with her nipples, passed on through our camp. Every stratum of society was represented, Hell's Angels to retirees to good old boys and buzz-cut girls to legal types and politicos in double-cab dual-wheel pickups with flourished, dyed-to-match trailers, trundling no fewer than 4 Harley-Davidson Ultras, each with a base price of $20,000. And every 10 yards or so, somebody signed that said, "Show us your tits." Eddie Dakota, who drove a BMW bike and had been to Sturgis many times, told me before we left that the rally is one thing, eye candy for men. It seemed like that. Many of the women were physically beautiful. That is to say, they looked like glossy ads for Harley Davidson. After 4 days and nights of vibration and sound and the smell of porta-potties and sex without curfew, I couldn't wait to leave. Riding behind Vernon, air blowing into a tangle so matted I had to pay a hairdresser to cut it out, I ascended that sage-clotted valley to reclaim the commonplace, discard hedonism as a waste of time. It was like having lived in a den of drooling hyenas. I could not grasp the concept of gathering for the sake of promoting human baseness. We topped the valley's lip, and I felt my decision to leave Vernon and to mark it, lifted my lace-trimmed Harley-Davidson muscle shirt and showed the South Dakota vastness my tits. After the EMTs loaded Josie Yellowfeather into the ambulance and Eddie and Huey stayed behind and I drove off in a world of dust, I headed west on Highway 95 to see Esther Whitman, a full-blood Nez Perce woman who lived in the house her husband built for her 60 years prior. There was little reason for my being there beyond the fact she refused to monitor her glucose levels. Esther wouldn't prick her finger for the blood required to saturate the glucose reagent strips because it made her fingers too sore for beadwork. The compromise, then, was that I come twice a week to collect a red sample from her earlobe, a trick I once learned from a young man who was a diabetic double amputee and who played the guitar. Esther's property set apart from the tribally owned lands, partitioned from neighboring fields by wild blackberry brambles and lilac hedges, the driveway perpendicular to Highway 95, circling a large sycamore between the garage and the house's side entrance. The Jeep idle crunched along until I depressed the brake and turned off the key, waited while 106.9 fizzled a news report about a Nez Perce woman stabbed in Lewiston, her white fiancé, the suspect. I worried about Esther living alone in her greenhouse. She didn't want to leave because she was doing all right. Esther raised and housed her children there, apart from reservation life, yet cooked for the various powwows and tribal feasts, watched her husband fade and die from heart disease, herself developed diabetes. The place was single-storied, sided with stained wood shingles, never carpeted, its floors lined with the hard-wearing patterned linoleum found in my grandparents' Adair County shacks. I felt comfortable there, at ease with all the vestiges of homemaking, like paper doll accessories from my past, the wood cook stove flanked by an enameled gas range in the kitchen, porcelain sink deep and single-drained, installed late and at some point converted from pump handle to knobbed taps. Zinc flour and sugar bins looked like gray wedges under the plank work surface of a freestanding cupboard, wood farm table for breakfast, formica and chrome in the dining room for guests. In the living room, clear vinyl over the good brocade couch, the chairs naga hide or worn fabric hidden by slip covers, an old pump organ, upright piano, framed daguerreotypes in black and whites hanging on front room walls, a young Indian woman in full regalia, suited burnished men with short braids, babies, and variously developed children, a picture of a long-haired, ruddy-bearded Jesus. Everything cluttered, covered with the trappings of an aged woman living alone, fooling herself with stacks of around to-its, a cache of projects waiting finishing touches. Arriving at Esther's was always the same. I knocked on the aluminum screen door that would soon be fitted with glass against the dropping autumn temperatures, and she hollered from the recesses of her living room, "Come in!" Then I rattled the door handle, called back, "It's locked," and she shuffled, house-slippered to the door to grin, greet me in Nez Perce-tinged English, lead me to our post by the north window and the floor lamp, the TV tray loaded with beadwork, and a Rubbermaid storage box full of ropes and ropes of miraculously small glass beads, dozens of colors layered upon themselves, microbic lights glinting and sparkling from all sides. She was beating a blue rose onto a buckskin belt, eventually to be flanked by eagles, then the American flag, all of which were already outlined in ballpoint ink. She told me the design came to her in a dream. Esther pointed to her left ear. "It's this one, this time," she said. I swabbed her lobe and did the prick with the plastic lancet, collected the ruby drop on the reagent strip, pressed a cotton ball against the stab to stop the bleeding, pushed the button on the palm-sized computer, waited the required 60 seconds, wiped the excess from the strip, inserted it into the machine. A tiny red sharps container waited in the unzipped confines of my nursing bag for the bloody cotton ball used lancet. HIV still hadn't arrived on the Nez Perce reservation, but was bound to. I wrapped the blood pressure cuff around her arm, pumped it up, put stethoscope to her throbbing heart, listened to lungs inflate, deflate, touched pulses in her feet. Afterwards, as usual, we sat for a long while, talking about beating, who she was going to hire to rake the leaves, stories about her children and grandchildren. I wanted to tell her about my troubles with Zach, ask her how one gets rid of a drunken poet. We both laughed, me at the improbability, she at her own limitations, when she told the story of burning a pan of potatoes earlier in the week, about black smoke filling the kitchen and her throwing the thing out the back door, and about having to wait for the air to clear on its own before the smoke alarm shut off, because she didn't dare try to climb a ladder and undo the batteries. I praised her for that bit of wisdom, then asked permission to put my feet on a nearby ottoman. She told me to go ahead, then I might as well feel like I was home. And so I did, sitting with her until late afternoon, dust speckles flickering close to the floor in the lowest slanting daylight. Bigfoot and the Safety Fair, Earth. May 23, 2001, Eagle Cap Wilderness, Oregon. I have a few theories about dark things that lurk in the woods. Having lived and camped and hiked away 27 years in the Pacific Northwest, I have felt things. A suspicion about a bodiless terror that more than once has caused me to gather my sleeping bag and await dawn by dozing in my car. On the Coeur d'Alene Reservation in Idaho, the tribal school art teacher, in the Coeur d'Alene language also a Suyapi or white person, told me she once saw a being 8 feet tall standing by a table in her art classroom in the tribal school at Desmet, and once, at Lapway, a Bigfoot sighting not 10 minutes from the clinic. We made a joke of it, painting huge pink lumbering footprints leading to the old parade grounds and the clinic's annual safety fair. When I questioned him, Leonard Wahoban assured me Bigfoot exists. We almost never get to see him, though, he said, because Bigfoot is a trickster, kin to coyote, and simply capable of extraordinary modes of travel, accomplished in the old way by assuming a more subtle form, say a milkweed or cottonwood tuft. Contrary to what I felt at the cabin outside Elk City where the boys and I spent that Mother's Day, at times the wilderness scares me to death. And I don't know why either, not when I felt completely safe wandering alone in Chicago, Louisville, Phoenix. At times I've wondered whether evil fell to the planet with some comet, is studded into the formation of the mountains of Idaho, or whether the settlers brought it with them. Whether that is why so few people even today choose to live here. Someone literary did once call it tough paradise. Perhaps the western U.S. is too saturated with the rot of human blood and true souls can't stand it. Or perhaps the divide is the culprit. Perhaps gentle spirits are like lightning bugs which don't survive west of the continental divide because they compete for habitat with their more aggressive, non-glowy twins. But then maybe it's the Pacific Northwest in general. Just before the safety fair, I took a trip over Snoqualmie Pass in northwest Washington with Vernon passed out drunk in the back and Ellen Barton's mother, Shirley, staring straight ahead from the passenger seat. I was doing each a favor, driving to Seattle so they could handle respective family business. Brett and Zach were at Mark's. It was late and dark. We had crossed the eastern Washington steps and were into the Cascade Range, headlights imposed on nothing but quiet trees, without so much as clearing her throat to prepare us for a break in more than an hour of silence, white-haired Shirley said in a very loud voice, "Do you believe in Bigfoot?" The road had been empty, Vernon silent but for the rare small snore. Shirley and I beyond our initial chit-chat, her large black purse perched motionless between her knees and lapped hands the entire time. I was mesmerized by the night and the fog line. Her words startled me so that I jumped. I spit surprise and laughed long and hard. Unfortunately, in this case, if Shirley's expression was any indication, the irony was obvious and entertaining only to me. Still, it took me a minute to gain control. Shirley fawned, certain she was the dumbest of the dumb. "No, no, please don't take me wrong," I said, "but what makes you think of Bigfoot all of a sudden?" "Well," she said, "if you're going to see him, this would be the place." Certain spots on the Nez Perce Reservation, too, felt downright sinister. Elmer Joe lived in an Airstream trailer down one of these traces, a branch off Highway 95 called Tom Beale Road. Elmer was one of my favorite people, even though he constantly ignored the most basic of health rules by refusing to wash his hands. He was well known for the drums he made using ancient, tedious methods. His front yard ringed with zinc tubs full of aging deer hides and a tanning solution made of rotting buffalo brains, which made me think of Ayla watching the bear brain eating ceremony in Jane Owl's Clan of the Cave Bear. Walking to the creek with soap after scraping hides or using the outhouse was, for Elmer, a Soyapo habit, apparently, although I never asked him. Whether he was truly stubborn or simply forgetful didn't matter. He still periodically needed treatment for diarrhea and vomiting. It was cool for October, wet, and several people had phoned claiming Elmer had the flu. Armed with an IV setup and glucose solution, I walked upstairs with his medical chart and asked Dr. Haskins to write orders for a peripheral line and medical transport so the docs could take a closer look. I knew from experience trying to get an IV into Elmer's mushy vessels was like trying to open a canned ham without its key. It would have to be done in the clinic, as always, and Elmer would, as always, refuse an ambulance. I dreaded going out to his smelly camp trailer. Nonetheless, I nodded my promise to Dr. Haskins, our lanky young physician from the North Carolina coast, a lumpy who drawled the familiar comforting drawl of my faraway kin.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia goes to the Harley rally in Sturgis, South Dakota with Vernon. She rests at the home of Esther Whitman after a long, difficult day, gets called to Elmer Joe's house when he contracts diarrhea from tanning deer hides. I drove west from Lapway toward Elmer's place, conscious of the sun deciding which way to best address central Idaho. Whether to filter through rain or to blaze outright, heightening autumn fields and ridges. Deciduous leaves in variegated tangerine and rust fluoresced during moments when the light broke through. Aspen trembled as if filled with the Holy Ghost. Tom Beale Road dissected Highway 95 west of Lapway, splitting north, then whipping east in parallel. Elmer's place was a few miles further, a shallow bowl in the earth rimmed by the road and Lapway Creek. The dip from the pavement along a gutted dirt driveway was, despite my repeated visits, unexpected, floating my stomach and heart, making counterfeit the rhythm of my breathing. Old cottonwood and birch arched over Elmer's place, the trailer and outhouse in full shade, the galvanized metal sweat lodge opposite, normally blinding in the sun, today radiating its own humidity, a warm gap amidst unseasonably cool temperatures. Smoke came from the stack, and the bare ass of Scotty Walter exited the lodge, his distinctive braid long and white against beige skin, hearing aids predictably turned off. Elmer's ass was naked, too. I tapped on the aluminum door, opening it in response to, "Is that you, nurse?" to find Elmer lying blatantly, clothesless, back toward me. On the upholstered bench, the generous bulk of his middle wedged between bony bent legs and a loose, oldish chest. The place smelled of previous cooking, leathery anal odors. The camp trailer's light accentuated the clawing, deflated nature of his flesh, assuring me that when I pinched his skin, it would tent, the sebaceous fluids that made it retractable and buoyant having been absorbed and used for things like circulating blood, lubrication for the brain and spinal cord. "You sick again, Elmer?" I asked, and he edged his head around far enough to nod, wave knuckled fingers in a bent half-salute. "I can't get up," Elmer said. "I need some clothes on." "I won't look, Elmer," I told him. "The doctor wants me to try and get a needle in." He turned onto his back, spreading a shirt over his genitals while I twisted a rubbery Penrose drain below his right elbow tourniquet fashion, clicked and slapped my fingers against the bowler aspect of his forearm, the radial and ulnar vasculature, trying to excite them enough to stand open and protest, but nothing. Elmer's eyes were deep in his sockets, his lips peeling and colorless, tongue parched and poking between his lips. He had reluctant venous return when I depressed his toenails. My needle wasn't going anyplace, and I was not going to subject him to an attempt. I scanned the crusty kitchen for a spoon, resorted to pouring a tablespoon of Gatorade into a sterile specimen cup, handed it to Elmer to sip, while I waded through the dogs and cats to conjure Scotty from the sweat house. The world outside was by then glistening like a bubble. The clouds had dissipated and faint morning rains twinkled and evaporated at once. Scotty was in blue jeans and a ribbon shirt by then, waved, walked over. "You came," he said, nodding when I asked him to help Elmer get dressed, only turning up his hearing aids after I yelled the same words a second time, then walking away. While he was gone, I toured Elmer's work area, some hides soaked in red-hued water in washtubs. Others were stretched and hanging in movable frames propped on old ladder-backed chairs and situated to capture the most sunlight. It smelled of elk camp and butchering meat. Around back, between the trailer and the one-seater, was a table, the place where a month prior Elmer showed me what strength it took to scrape loose hair and meat after a skin is aged. I lectured him then about opportunistic pathogens, creatures that love to grow in rotting hides, creatures that hate human intestines. But he just kept scraping as though my speech were not worth the listening, and I predicted this moment while standing in that one. Elmer made magic and medicine from the demise of animals, drums, otolotls, shields. I feared his own death would eventually arise from this place where dying and living fused in creation. I thought about buying one of Elmer's drums and told him how badly I wished I could, to make a heartbeat when I needed to embrace myself. I told him about the fullness I felt the first time I heard an Indian drum at the opening ceremonies for the Minority Health Conference in Portland, Oregon, led by the Warm Springs tribe. That drum beat was one of the things that drew me to the Indian Health Service, before the divorce, before everything. Elmer responded by showing me the books he studied about drum making from other tribes and said, "Some people pay high as $250 for a good drum." The baby was truly only a baby, 15 months old, and if the TB test Wilma McPhee, RN, planted in the 3-year-old sister's forearm reacted as well, the search for an index case was likely to end at a symptomatic babysitter. Dr. Baylor, another of our physicians and a member of the Macaw tribe of Washington, whose Bengali wife once served me a strange drink made from yogurt, onions, and soda water, was waiting for me when I arrived at the clinic with Elmer and had already questioned the little boy's parents along these lines, who insisted that no one in their circle was ill. No chronic cough, fatigue, night sweats, unexplained weight loss. Our pharmacists, Alan Steinmetz and Mike Nichols, searched Lewiston pharmacies by phone for pediatric isoniazid and rifampin and paroxidine, or vitamin B6, which treated the B6 deficiency caused by the isoniazid. The recommended course was 6 months to a year, a haunting reminder of all the shots of penicillin given to me as a kid to treat recurring tonsillitis, now contributing to chronic yeast. I wondered what fragile destiny awaited Joshua Rubidoux, thanks to the crippling of his microflora. 2 days later, Joshua was diagnosed with a tuberculosis bacterium, a patient but deadly organism walled off and dormant in the apex of his left lung. I drove the short miles from the clinic to the dark shade of Coyote Canyon Road, where the family's double-wide sat on a gravel piece of ground up the hill from their fireworks stand. I tried to talk myself into feeling better for not having spent the previous day searching for an index case, someone in the extended family or a close friend from another community with active TB, someone newly gaunt and gray and coughing blood, but nothing could convince me. I knew I had not initiated the investigation because I didn't want to crank the key on that particular can of rotted fish. I was familiar with Corinne, the 3-year-old, having reviewed her medical record during the course of my new public health nursing chart audit, The audit was meant to provide data to support switching Tamara Olson's half-time job to full-time. The Public Health Association recommended one public health nurse and one half-time clerical person per 1,200 population. There were 4,800 NSPERS. The one clerical person was Amanda Alfred, who also ran the phones. Rarely did she have time to type. Programs such as maternal child health, which was one of the first human service areas to be contracted directly to the tribe by the Indian Health Service, known as a 638 contract, was disorganized and under the scrutiny of the Portland Area Office in Bellingham, Washington, through which all policies and problems for the Northwest tribes were filtered. Ellen Barton had already verbally reprimanded me for interfering with the MCH program. I guess you could say fear for my job as much as anything led me to lay aside my hunch about Corinne's four clinic visits for urinary tract infections, two at Kamei and two at Lapway, all noted by various locum tenens or fill-in docs. So rather than haul my nurse trappings straight out to the Rubidoux's well-kept trailer to examine a baby who in clinic appeared to be undersized and depressed, similarly his three-year-old sister whose limbs were bone clad by brief muscle and hazing skin, I spent Tuesday at my desk behind closed doors drafting a new epidemiology report form and my program's TB protocols so that I could excuse myself for delaying my report to Eddie Dakota, the BIA criminal investigator, and Ellen Barton, and the doctors at the clinic. I hated that the responsibility fell to me, and I hated that there was little enough coordination between the two clinics that no one suspected sexual abuse in the child. But that is what people did. Jumped clinics for pain meds, jumped clinics for sympathy, jumped clinics for little girls who peed pus and blood because some neighbor or family member was transmitting bacteria from adult-sized hands to little girl bladders. I wondered about the gravel as a metaphor, whether the family had lain plastic and rock over the life beneath to avoid the task of maintaining it. Nonetheless, I walked up the dog-free wooden steps and rapped on yet another metal-screen door, escorted inside by the mother, a smallish woman whose beaded earrings dangled softly against the backdrop of her long, dark hair. Josh was sitting in a walker, little Corinne on the couch. The place smelled of recent pine saw but had the look of unpretentious order that comes from regular cleaning. No evidence of house pets, no stacks of beer cases, no Thunderbird bottles on the counter, no twigs hanging over door frames to ward off bad spirits, no lingering essence of burning sweetgrass. The drapes on the back windows were pulled shut, front vinyl mini-blinds open. A lamp with an amber glass base was switched on, the globe perhaps glass, perhaps plastic. A bas-relief pattern and lava swirls distinguished it, nonetheless. One by one, I weighed and measured the length of the children, wrapped a cloth tape, measure across their dark silk thread hair to determine head circumference, plotted points on a growth chart. Both were below the fifth percentile for their age. I looked in noses and ears, listened to hearts, lungs, palpated the angry half-dollar-sized wheels rising like pink sponge cake on the insides of their left forearms, Corinne showing positive too. I did all this despite the fact that I was repeating actions done 2 days ago in clinic. It made me feel credible, and I thought my projection of careful authority was the only thing between me and the children in the front door. I asked Corinne to hop on 1 foot, count to five, name colors, let Josh manipulate my stethoscope, watched for purpose of movement, listened to his syllables, da, ba, gave them both blocks to stack, Corinne paper and crayons, Josh a yarn doll. Both were timid but cooperative, looking to their parents for approval before accepting any item or performing any action. Mr. and Mrs. Rubidoux sat quietly in opposite corners watching. I do this for all home visits with children, I told them. Early childhood development is an area of extra training I have. Afterwards, I shook hands limply, mimicking the style I'd learned, promised there were no worries, no developmental delays, nothing required beyond the weekly doses of medicine for the TB. Nothing was out of the ordinary. But I was sick with suspicion. I saw what I thought were parental masks of over-worry, hoping I wouldn't see the underlying disinterest. I ran the Rubidoux through my new epidemiology interview form, little square blocks marching defiantly up the left side of two columns of symptoms, drowsiness, chills, fatigue, rash, cough, headache, anorexia, fever, vomiting, conspiracy theorists all, waiting for suspicious accusations to be frankly declared and etched in fire starter flint by a self-righteous black checkmark, courtesy my government skillcraft pen. I wanted to darken them all, line to line and corner to corner, each and every one. Page 2 of the forum titled Exposure. Where did they buy their milk? Bovine tuberculosis is rare in pasteurized America, but not unheard of. Where had the family traveled in the past 6 months and with whom? With whom had they shared car rides? Who sat next to them in church? Typically, TB is spread among housemates of 6 months' duration. It is transferred by droplets of sputum containing active bacterium, proliferates in the lungs as it creates coughing, dwindling people. And TB, like syphilis, is increasing in incidence in immune systems throttled by HIV, except that TB is becoming resistant. Sometimes it takes regimens of 4 antibiotics to knock it down, and even those are failing. And the wages of sin is death. Finally, Mr. Rubidoux said, "We have answered your questions, which are the same as Dr. Baylor at the clinic." "Please," I stood and added, "I need to test people who may have held your babies. Somebody out there is dying and doesn't know it, and giving the sickness to others, obviously. Don't you see? Your children have it." Mrs. Rubidoux looked at her husband, finally turning to me to say, "Our family sometimes eats meals together at the house of Vance Weasel." The Nursing Code of Conduct asserts that nurses cannot accept gifts from patients and cannot fall in love with them. And so by now I had broken both rules. Once, a cancer patient named Elizabeth gave me an expensive bottle of Elizabeth Taylor's signature perfume, Diamonds. At first, I refused it, citing the profession's position on accepting gifts from patients. "I'm going to die," she said. "What difference can it make?" I also fell in love with Vance Weasel. I might have been living with Vernon, but I was in love with Vance Weasel. The textbook explanation refers to Vance's dependence and my need to care for others. But textbooks couldn't bear witness to an outstanding mind trapped in a disabled body, a body that served through 20 years the thrills and challenges of rodeo, of being a Nez Perce growing up in Idaho in the 1950s, surviving a public education, only to be broken by the horrible. The horrible with names like ankylosing spondylitis, rheumatoid arthritis, Reiter's syndrome. The irony was that Vance didn't require or request services. I met him because a dog bite occurred in the vicinity of his home, and I blindly tried to investigate the thing before writing a program policy stipulating the IHS public health nurse refers dog bites for investigation to BIA law enforcement with a CC to the IHS Environmental Health Officer, or EHO. Keeping track of dog bites was like trying to track mosquito bites. Nobody wanted to deal with them. The Kamei nurse practitioner, Liddy Yupnovich, whose professionalism and bouncy straight hair I admired, on both counts mine were corkscrewed and irascible, and the Kamei nurse, Tamara Olson, once had to exhume a dead dog themselves to ship its head to Boise for rabies inquiry. The sum of two add-ins, a child with bite wounds, and a jurisdictional squabble between law enforcement agencies at that end of the reservation. My second introduction to Vance came when a basketball crashed through his bedroom window, and the Nez Perce Tribal Housing Authority, NEPTHA, hesitated to replace it. I didn't know whether responsibility actually fell to that program, but Vance was purchasing his house from HUD, and his disability status made him eligible for certain other assistance programs. The family contacted me based on a rumor that I'd managed to get a ramp put in for a paraplegic tribal member, but the rumor was only partly true. It was the previous public health nurse who arranged the work order to construct the ramp. I simply wrote a letter reminding the carpenter he had been hired to do a job. The ramp and accessible bathroom materialized the next week. So, in a letter to NEPTHA, addressing Vance's situation, noting that a case of pneumonia was enough to initiate this particular tribal member's demise, referring to his recent upper respiratory illness, I suggested housing might be in a position of neglect if they didn't arrange for an intact window. It took less than a week for a window of double-pane glass sandwiching wire mesh to show up.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be. Beautiful to me.
Breath your soul.
You were always beautiful to me.
Breath your soul, mama.
Oh. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.